Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Untold billions of dollars have been sent to developing countries in Africa and Asia to improve living standards and alleviate poverty. Some of those programs have had great success, especially in health and education. But most of the programs aimed at poverty have had, at best, limited success, usually on a limited scale, and many projects have completely squandered the money allotted them or enriched government elites. My guest today has had a novel approach to alleviating poverty that first drew scorn, but is now gaining traction in world anti-poverty efforts. My guest is Paul Polak, a social entrepreneur who has advocated market-based solutions to poverty, in essence creating very inexpensive products that can greatly improve productivity, sometimes as much as double, triple, or quadruple a poverty-stricken family's income, and most importantly, treating those people as consumers, not the recipients of aid. He's already created businesses that provide cheap, clean water and inexpensive, sustainable irrigation systems to rural villagers and subsistence farmers. And given that there's at least a billion subsistence farmers that lack access to small plot irrigation or how to farm better, crop insurance, lack rudimentary shelters, having neither latrines nor toilets or electricity, there are huge opportunities that exist for innovative, affordable products and services in those areas. Polak is the co-author of The Business Solution to Poverty, Designing Products and Services for 3 Billion New Customers, and he'll be giving the University of Tulsa's Collins College of Business Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Paul Polak, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
In your book, The Business Solution to Poverty, at first glance, the idea that the best solution for reducing poverty is through business, I think the first idea most people would have is that's going to be exploitive. But actually, you make a pretty strong case that the development of products and services that can simultaneously lift families out of poverty and provide a return to business is achievable. And the third impact is, will it be environmentally exploitive or sustainable? You make a pretty good case for that. Give us a sense of how you got involved in this idea of catering a business to consumers who make a dollar a day or $2 a day.
Well, I didn't start out, Rich, to apply business principles. I had a pretty open mind, and my approach is to talk to the poor people as customers first. So I talked over 25 years to more than 3,000 dollar a day families and walked with them through their fields. And the reason I got to business approaches as opposed to other approaches to ending poverty is when I got to know these families through 1 hour to 6 hour long conversations, the thing that I asked them then was, why are you poor? And the most common answer is, we're poor because we don't have enough money. Which seems sort of obvious, but
yeah.
it's an obvious thing that a lot of approaches to poverty seem to have missed. A lot of people look at poverty as caused by powerlessness. Others say that it's lack of education. Others say that it's lack of infrastructure. But the poor people themselves say that it's because they don't have enough money. Well, then how do they earn the money they have? Well, most of the dollar-a-day farm families that I talk to earn most of their income from farming. That's, again, not too ridiculous. You'd expect that answer, although a lot of them work off the farm for additional income.
Mm-hmm.
So when I looked more closely at how they make a living from farming, what became immediately strikingly apparent is that most of the dollar-a-day people live on one-acre farms, and they are actually small. These one-acre farms are actually small survival enterprises. So most of the poor people in the world who live under less than $2 a day, I started focusing on dollar-a-day, are rural, and most of their income comes from farming. And to run a one-acre farm and try to survive with it is really an enterprise to begin with. They have to make decisions every day about whether to plant the subsistence crops or more valuable market-driven crops like off-season fruits and vegetables. They're very short of capital, so they have to decide whether to buy seed or pay for some medicines for a family member with pneumonia. And as we looked at their farm enterprises, the thing that most of them said that they needed to earn more survival income from their enterprise was water control for their crops. Because if they could grow fruits and vegetables in the dry season, when prices were two or three times as high, they could make out much better. So we started off making available radically affordable irrigation devices. And again, we could, the first device we saw in Bangladesh was a treadle pump, which was sort of like a Stairmaster that could, you walk on a couple of treadles and you bring up enough water, because the water table in the dry season was only 5 or 10 feet below their feet.
But you don't have electricity, but you don't have any way of pumping that water up other than manual hand pumps.
That's right. Well, you can set up a diesel pump, but that costs $500 at the time, and that's too much for them. So some of the richer farmers use diesel pumps. We just sold to them. We ended up treating them as customers instead of as recipients of charity. That worked a lot better. This treadle pump costs $8, and that's one of the key things that works with poor people. Radically affordable tools and services. And if you drilled a tube well with a local well driller and put the that treadle pump on the tube well, which is basically a 2-inch PVC pipe going down to maybe 40 feet with the water coming up maybe 10 feet from the surface, and you put a filter on that, that whole thing costs $25. And the average farmer earned $100 from his investment of $25 after all expenses in the first year. And as they got to be better farmers, they could earn $500 from that $25 investment. When we tried giving treadle pumps away, it didn't work too well.
Why didn't it work when you tried to give them away?
Well, first of all, a lot of people, when you give things away, a lot of people who are not really willing to put in the work, anybody will accept a free gift.
And maybe try to resell it down the road.
Yeah, but then that gives you, let's say they sell it for $5. That gives them $5. It's a help. In fact, people do resell. There were hand pumps provided by UNICEF in Bangladesh, and they were heavily subsidized. Those hand pumps were more like $20. And farmers could get them for $3. They would melt them down for scrap and sell the scrap. So I have a lot of experiences like that. Another irrigation tool that we designed and sold was drip irrigation. When we did that in a country where we couldn't operate as a development organization, which was Zimbabwe, mm-hmm. we had to give the drip irrigation systems away as a relief effort. Now, only about 25% of them were actually put to use. So with experiences like that, what I learned was that what worked best is to treat poor people as customers instead of as recipients of charity. And one of the basic principles that I learned is that you can't donate people out of poverty. They have to invest their own time and money. You can help them by designing products and services that can dramatically increase their livelihood. So in the end, we ended up with a treadle pump initially, energizing a whole network of local entrepreneurs. We ended up working with 75 little workshops in Bangladesh who manufactured the treadle pump. We recruited between 2,000 and 3,000 village dealers who sold it at a 12% margin. And we trained about 3,000 well drillers who drilled the well that the treadle pump was put on for about between 5 and 10 cents a foot. And then we focused on marketing to people who often couldn't read or write. So we did things like village theater. We eventually
you made movies.
Bollywood movies.
You made Bollywood movies, and you had an advertisement for the treadle pump in the middle of it.
Yes. We told a story of a farmer who changed his life and his daughter's life when he bought a treadle pump. It was a real tearjerker. It's a 90-minute movie. But all of those experiences came together to make it clear that a business approach was by far the best way to help people move out of poverty. So that's what we've done, and we eventually sold 1.5 million treadle pumps in Bangladesh. And that's what we're doing now with these companies that we're starting.
Yeah, and let's just talk a little bit about the treadle pump. You've sold about 1.5 million. That's probably affected an awful lot of families in which they can, what, double, triple their income on the farm?
You add $100, and that's the average in the first year. If you're living on $1 a day, it's $300, so you're adding 30%. But they can move right on up if they apply themselves to $500, which doubles their income.
Yeah.
So that's 1.5 million treadle pumps. But altogether, we sold more than 2 million treadle pumps all over the world. That's to 2 million families. Each of those families have 5 or 6 members. So 2 million times 5 or 6, you get up to 12 million just with treadle pumps, individuals who made enough money to move out of poverty, in effect.
And the thing you write about in the book is that this is a market. You know, it's you have to engineer, you have to do a lot of work in your engineering to make sure this is very inexpensive, but it has to be high quality, can't be cheap, so it breaks and farmers won't use it. But you're talking about a market that's around 1.4 to 1.6 billion people.
Actually, if you...
I'm thinking $1 a day, but $2 a day, it's $2 billion or more.
Yeah, $2 is $2.7 billion. $1 a day is something like $1.1 billion.
Yeah. So this is a major market, but companies see a person that might spend $25, $40 as somebody probably not worth investing in. And you say there's a pretty good return available for actually investigating what they need, making products that they will use that will lift them out of poverty and make a return at the same time.
I'm creating 4 companies. Each of these companies is designed to transform the livelihoods of at least 100 million $2 a day customers, generate $10 billion in revenues, and earn sufficient profits to attract global commercial investors. And I think that some of these products are a lot less than $25. For instance, Spring Health sells safe drinking water to each family, delivered to their home in a 10-liter jerry can at a price of about 7 cents a day. And that's significantly less than what the family spends in the year for treating the illnesses they get from drinking bad water. So if you do that at volume, you can actually make a very attractive profit.
And that's involved, I guess you're doing fairly small-scale electrochlorination units, and you have a huge distributor system, which basically, instead of having big, huge, it's all decentralized. And that's a big central concept in a lot of your ideas, is decentralizing the plan so that it's easy to get to these very remote villages where I think you document a few families in a village. And I know one of the sons, he works on the farm, but he also is a delivery boy bringing these jerry cans to various families. He's adding to the family bottom line. They're spending less money in medical care from drinking bad water. And yet you've got this very extensive dealer network that is providing this service in relatively low quantities per dealer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you zoom out from that picture, that is, I believe, the coming trend. Since the Industrial Revolution, global businesses have been based on the economy of scale. So manufacturing is large centralized plants. You can't build cars in a village decentralized plant. But increasingly, distributed energy is the trend in energy. And these $2 a day customers represent 40% of all the customers in the world. And so if you can negotiate radical decentralization and still make money from last mile distribution, there's a huge untapped market that it opens up.
My guest today is Paul Pollack. He is a social entrepreneur, the founder and CEO of Windhorse International, a for-profit social venture launching new businesses to serve the poor. He is also the co-author of The Business Solution to Poverty, designing products and services for 3 billion new customers. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa's Collins College of Business lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center. He'll be speaking about his work in these various companies. Now, one of the central processes of how you come up with a product that is both affordable to people in poverty and also be able to make a return on your own investment is what you call zero-based design. What exactly is zero-based design?
Well, zero-based design, we describe it in some detail in the book. It's the equivalent of zero-based budgeting. In zero-based budgeting, instead of tweaking last year's budget and maybe adding more to R&D and a little bit less in personnel and more in travel costs, you start from scratch and you say, if we started this business from scratch today, how would we allocate the budget? What would we do? And so zero-based design is exactly the same concept. If you want to deliver safe drinking water, how would you design it to be radically affordable? How would you design? And design for me is much more than designing technology. Once you have a transformative technology, maybe you solve 10% of the problem. The biggest part of the problem is the business strategy. So zero-based design focuses on radical affordability of products and services, but it also focuses on designing a marketing strategy that works, a last-mile distribution strategy, and all of these variables have to come together to design a full business based on a transformative technology that reaches 100 million customers. One of the things that we talk about is what I call the Don't Bother Trilogy. If you haven't talked to at least 100 typical customers before you start, if the customer who buys the technology can't make at least two or three times their investment in the first year, and if you can't sell 100 million of them, don't bother. So one of the features of zero-based design is how to build scale into the design of the technology and the business from the very beginning. So all of those things together in a systems design framework make up zero-based design.
Now, in the case of your Spring Health, I think you started last year with, 10 operational chlorine plants. You were serving about 74,000. I think you're going to about triple or quadruple that number this year and serve about nearly half a million families. I think as you look down, you're thinking that by 2016 you'll be serving over a million families, and this year you're expecting to make $1 million in revenue, and this seems like it's a great idea. Safe drinking water is a big problem in many parts of the world. Now, you also show a great idea of zero-based design, but in which they didn't do that last walk around with the various families who are your potential consumers. And it didn't work. And that was this idea of creating charcoal out of sugarcane waste in Haiti. Of course, sugarcane, the big crop. Haiti uses wood charcoal. The deforestation is a huge problem in Haiti. And some really brilliant people came up with this idea of a way in which you can fairly easily, at a low cost, make charcoal out of sugarcane waste. What happened?
It wasn't designed sufficiently as a business enterprise. The hope was that very poor small farmers in poor rural areas in Haiti could gain access to sugarcane waste from a sugarcane factory. It's called Pegas. And with a beautifully designed, simple, appropriate technology, using a 55-gallon drum to basically, it's a process called pyrolysis, in which after you add a lot of heat by burning some of the gas, what you're left with is charcoal. And the idea was that families could collect this gas, make charcoal, sell it in the market, earn $500 a year in new income, and have for their own stoves access to burnable charcoal that didn't come from destroying the environment by cutting down trees. The problem was, first of all, when people started using this gas from the factory in volume, all of a sudden they couldn't get it for free anymore. The price went up to the point where it was difficult to make any money. But a more basic problem was that the strategy of making charcoal at a barrel at a time didn't produce enough volume of saleable charcoal for each farmer to make it worthwhile. They could probably, when I did the calculations, do better by just hiring out as unskilled labor. And so a simple adjustment in which you design the charcoal making technology to do, let's say, 5 or 10 barrels at a time could probably make it more labor efficient. So you have to, the basic principle here is that you have to work out the details so that each of the people who are helped by improving their livelihoods are actually making money, and it's a more attractive proposition than going out and just hiring out as unskilled labor. To their credit, the group at MIT, who are good friends of mine and who've done amazing things in the development space, it's D-Lab, and Amy Smith is a genius at making appropriate technologies. That group has now learned from what happened in Haiti, and they're doing in Eastern Africa more efficient, labor-intensive, higher volume charcoal making, and they're beginning to be successful. But that was a very useful experience in Haiti in figuring out how to make things more business-like so that every person in the initiative makes a profit. You have to make it attractive to the factory that's giving you the agricultural waste. And most importantly, you have to have the people who are earning livelihoods from making charcoal make enough money to make it worth their while.
Hmm. Now, what is the reaction from traditional non-governmental organizations and big governmental organizations like World Bank, IMF? I mean, those they're all about huge development project, huge infrastructure. They're not really, and I don't think they're really well suited for ending poverty. In fact, a lot of that money gets siphoned away through corruption. But what about your NGOs and especially the charity projects that are helping set up microlending? What's their reaction to this idea that business coming in, making a profit, yet selling products that also lift people out of poverty? What's their reaction to that?
Well, I tell you what, it's changed over time. When I started pushing market-based approaches to poverty 30 years ago, the reaction was much like if you loudly passed gas in church. People thought that idea was ridiculous. Not only that, but the conventional wisdom was that it was the corporations that were the root cause of poverty. And to some extent, that's true in some instances. But what's happened over time is that attitudes have changed. Market-based approaches to poverty are becoming much more popular. But even so, within the current context in development approaches, in my view, over the last 20 years, the money we've spent, it's more than $1 trillion to end poverty in places like Africa, has really failed. With rare exceptions. And in the development space today, many of the big NGOs don't really feel comfortable with operating as a business. The charity model is still the prevailing model, although there's a great deal of interest now in market-based approaches and impact investment and so on. But if you look at how the total investment dollars are spent, most of the money goes to governments, where you have through organizations like the World Bank and UNDP. And when you do development aid on a massive budget, it's very hard to get to the little villages where most of the poor people are. And as you say, a lot of the money is wasted through corruption. But even in the large NGOs, I would say that the current central model is still based on subsidy and charity, although increasingly people in these development organizations are looking at making their activities more market-driven.
Mm. Well, at the end of the book, you sort of lay out the groundwork for some great investment ideas, and the fact that, you know, you say still 1 billion poor farmers around the world lack access to small plot irrigation or information on how to farm better. 1 billion poor farmers lack access to crop insurance or any sort of insurance that could lessen their financial challenges. You have over 1 billion people live in rudimentary shelters. About 1 billion people have neither latrines nor toilets. 1 billion people with no access to electricity. These are just basic elemental conditions that are ripe for an entrepreneur that has a great idea.
Yes. A lot of people sort of wring their hands about poverty and what a terrible thing it is. I regard each of those things and many other things like that as remarkable business opportunities to create new virgin markets. And if you look at it that way, you not only can form profitable large businesses, but you can transform poverty at the same time.
All right. Well, we look forward to your lecture here at the University of Tulsa. The name of the book is The Business Solution to Poverty. Paul Pollack, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rich.
Paul Pollack is a social entrepreneur, founder and CEO of Windhorse International, a for-profit social venture launching new businesses to serve the poor. He is also the co-author of The Business Solution to Poverty, Designing Products and Services for 3 Billion New Customers. And he'll be speaking at the University of Tulsa's Lorton Performance Center in a Collins College of Business lecture tonight at 7. That lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.